Friends, as I embark upon this privileged and very pleasant task of reading to you my book, The Pathway to Perfection, two quotations from our Bible, the New Testament, in fact, have come to my mind. One of them records the statement by our Lord Christ, who said, "Ye shall be perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." Matthew 5, verse 48, Revised Version. And then the words of St. Paul came to my mind. He wrote, "Till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ." Epistle to the Ephesians, chapter 4, verse 13. As we consider these statements, so appropriate to our subject, I suggest that two facts must be remembered when considering the doctrine that all men are evolving through successive lives on earth to the stature of perfected manhood. These two facts are, first, that evolution is dual. The spiritual self of each one of us unfolds inherent powers, and the mortal man develops capacities perfectly to express them. And the second fact is that it is not the present named bodily person which becomes perfect, but the spiritual self, the monad ego, the real immortal self of man, within which from the beginning has existed the potentiality of attainment. It is this which attains to perfection. At the end of age-long evolution, the dweller in the innermost, the God within every human being, attains human perfection and enters the superhuman kingdom of nature. With these thoughts of mine in mind, let me now turn directly to the introduction of my book. There I have written, "Man, as man, is a bundle of weaknesses, a concatenation of disabilities. Superhuman man is compact of strength, and is beyond all human limitations. The difference between these two is well nigh incalculable by man, who nevertheless contains within himself the germ of superhumanity. The change from man to superman, especially if it is to be accomplished with abnormal speed, demands the utmost effort. Man does possess the power swiftly to make the change, but success will remain beyond his reach as long as he is only half-hearted in his endeavor. The heights are so colossal and the strain so severe that success only becomes possible when the whole being is dedicated without reserve to the great quest. The aspirant must evoke all the powers of the soul and direct them with uttermost sincerity and will to the sublime objective, for then alone can man quickly achieve superhumanity. Insincerity is amongst the greatest of all hindrances on the occult path. insincerity corrodes the integrity of the soul, destroys the new growth as rapidly as it is made, and mars the beauty of the opening bud, of which, as canker, it eats away into the heart. Insincerity also bars the passage of pure reason as it seeks to illumine the brain. Half-heartedness also renders occult development impossible, for only with his whole self, with every part of his nature, and with all his will applied to the great endeavor, may the aspirant attain the heights in advance of the normal time. However, this has been and is being achieved. Supermen exist. They also once were men. Ages and ages ago, they awoke to the quest, felt the stirring of the monadic fire, and, gradually gathering strength, they embarked upon the steep, straight, narrow way, which they knew would take them to their goal. Steadfastly enduring, rarely yielding, in growing self-mastery, they ascended the heights and reached the goal. The existence and the attainment of supermen are the assurance to every man that the goal does exist and is attainable. Let none doubt that, therefore. Let there be neither misgiving nor questioning concerning this supreme endeavor. Success is utterly assured for all who steadfastly endure to the triumph of the end. Reward, beyond all telling, is theirs who have attained. Themselves, beyond the possibility of pain, they are able to heal the pain of humanity. Themselves, beyond all strife, they are able to bring peace to the hearts of men. Illumined, they become light-bringers to mankind and teachers to those who have ears to hear. Safe forever, they save mankind. Keepers of the sacred light of truth, they illumine with truth itself the questing minds of men. Their hearts are ever open to all joy and all sorrow of man. They are the refuge of the wounded heart and of the sore afraid. Naught vanquishes them who themselves are vanquishers. Nothing daunts them who themselves have conquered all enemies within and without, have passed over every obstacle, and have ascended every height. Knowing the very worst, having fought and overcome the direst evils that can possibly beset mankind, having beaten off all that assails the questing soul, serene in their knowledge of omnipotence concerning their own lives, they are the sure shields and the unfailing supports of all who seek their aid. To have become all this is their great reward. Similarly, to become is the sure reward of all of us who successfully tread the way of holiness, as Isaiah called it, the pathway to perfection. They would say directly to those of us who would follow them to those heights on which they stand, arise, all you who would attain. Send up your cry for light and enter fearlessly upon the upward way. It is for you. It calls you. It is your destiny to succeed. Aid awaits you. Your teacher is near you, watching you. Look not back, but forward, and you will see his face. Earth's supermen await upon Earth's men, ready to assist each one who answers to the call. And, with sincerity and wholeheartedness, gives himself entirely to the quest of light and power and truth, aspiring ardently to become a servant and a savior of the world. Is the worldless life still so attractive that it binds you to the world? Is earthly light so beautiful that it blinds you to heavenly beauty? Are you so wedded to the world that severance therefrom is as yet impossible? If so, then your time has not yet come. But if all fails around you, and life seems a hollow mockery, and worldly gain and power a sham, then your time has come. Arise and seek that which alone endures and is real, the spiritual life with its crown of spiritual power and a serene bliss that nothing in existence can evermore disturb. Not lightly, but with deep sincerity, let your resolve be made. Balance for yourself the two alternatives and make your choice between the worldly life with its fleeting joys and temporary gains and the spiritual life with its everlasting bliss and peace. That choice between impotence to meet your own and others' need and omnipotence to conquer self and lead others to like victory should not be difficult. Make the choice and come to join the ranks of those whose choice was made long ago and who steadfastly persisted until the triumph at the end came over self and mergence with the one self of all. Now, friends, from that introduction, I begin to read from chapter 1 of my book. It's called The Secret Leaven. The secret leaven, unconsciously to mankind, is ceaselessly at work within every man. A fiery power from the monad, the inmost self, plays continuously into and through the reincarnating individuality, the ego. Whether the personality, the mortal man, or woman, is immediately influenced or not, the leavening process is continuous, despite commission of even the grossest crimes. Duality and divergence of nature and mode of existence between the immortal and the mortal parts of man are most marked in unawakened man. For the ego lives its own largely inner life in its own world, concerned at that state of evolution with the gestatory processes occurring within it. Will, wisdom, and intelligence are all present germinally, from the moment of individualization, from the animal into the human kingdoms. Very slowly, in terms of earth time, these three powers, will, wisdom, and intelligence, change from the germinal to the embryonic state. and fired from within by the dweller in the innermost, or monad, stimulated from without by the activity of the formal mind, intelligence gradually develops through hundreds of lives. Wisdom and intuition follow, and ultimately the true will of man assumes the direction of his whole existence. These three, intellect, intuition, and will, are not separate from one another. Intelligence cannot function or exist without wisdom and will, however slight their expression. Wisdom demands intelligence as vehicle and will as driving force, whilst will in its turn is dependent upon both intelligence and wisdom for manifestation below its own natural level. Nevertheless, the germination, unfoldment, and ultimate perfecting of each attribute, will, wisdom, and intelligence, takes place in succession, though all ceaselessly interact. According to its nature, the experiences of a given human life may either retard or hasten these processes. Intensive activity, evoked by special opportunities, quickens interior development. A quiet, rural life leaves the ego but little affected. An indulgent life offers no aid, save that the effects are educative. A criminal life similarly educates, but its adverse karma or operation of the law of cause and effect may bring conditions for several lives which so hamper personal activity that the ego gains little or nothing from them. Excessive criminality places such a karmic drag under the law of cause and effect upon succeeding incarnations that all direct profit from them in terms of inner expansion can be lost. Even under such conditions, the interior egoic unfoldment continues. Nothing can prevent that. When once the monad has found the individual vehicles of will, wisdom, and intelligence, for the monad is pressure to moreness. A title, friends, I interpolate for the monad, pressure to moreness. I continue to read. It is fiery, spiritual power, imbued with intelligence, irresistibly impelled to expand. Before attachment to and evolution through individual vehicles, it is universal in character. Its rays extend on every side equally and indifferently, like those of its prototype, the sun. For long ages, through the elemental, mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms of nature, the monad has been unaware of self-expression. It has existed and moved to moreness, but unfocused and non-directionally, as it were. But at individualization, its beams become parallel and shine downwards into depths of density of matter, into the submonadic planes, along a predetermined path, which passes through the new-formed spiritual ego and into a single physical body when in incarnation. The monadic rays, then, which resemble currents of intelligence imbued electric fire, constitute the leavening agency, ever active as spiritual yeast within the inner self of man. Even surrender to evil and the powers of evil cannot quench this monadic fire. Nothing can thwart it, though deliberate choice of evil can retard the process of self-perfecting upon which, as ego, it is perpetually engaged. Lost personalities may tear away so large a portion of the higher intellect that the process of individualization must, as it were, be repeated. But as soon as that is achieved, the leavening power of the monadic fire at once resumes its activity. Thus, no spiritual soul is ever lost. No monad can ever fail, however deep the degradation into which the personality, the mortal human being, may fall. Victory by spirit over matter is utterly assured, for the leavening power of spirit is both infinite and irresistible, whilst the resistance and restriction characteristic of matter, these are finite and conquerable. The monad, who is as Arjuna of the Bhagavad Gita, a book which I recommend to you, the monad who is Arjuna inevitably conquers the enemies who symbolize the material vehicles of the ego personality, whilst the Lord Sri Krishna, who was Arjuna's master, is the Lord God itself, the synthesis and source of all monads. The deeper the depths into which the ego personality falls, the slower the process of self-perfecting. In the words of time, time is lost and suffering is endured. But victory is in no way rendered unsure in consequence. Men like Hitler delay, but cannot frustrate the fulfillment of the will to moreness, inherent in the great breath, and therefore inherent in all monadic breaths of the great breath. I interpolate, dear friends, the great breath is the title of that power of the creative logos by which all things are made, whilst the monad is sometimes referred to, and very beautifully and expressively, as a breath of the great breath. A wonderful title. I resume from the book. The whole of humanity is in varying degrees involved in both the triumphs and the defeats of all individuals. All monads are formed of the one spiritual fire, are breaths of the one breath, are components of the composite monad, which is the Logos, or Lord of all. At the monadic level, therefore, all intimately share in all activities, all fruits, all attainments, and all delays. At the egoic level, this sharing is somewhat reduced, because separate individuality which exists there has temporarily divided off the one divine monadic fire and life into largely self-acting compartments. And at the personal, physical level, in which you who are listening and I who are reading to you are awake just now, at the personal, physical level, the sharing is reduced to a minimum, for there individuality is made still more distinct by diverse and extremely individual experience and karma. and by the bodily separateness of one person from another. Only at the monadic level, therefore, can full unity be affirmed. Only in the white light are all colored rays wholly at one. Now, Chapter 2, In the Hall of Silence. The steps upon the way of holiness lead towards the Hall of Silence, wherein the first regular step upon the path is taken. It is no outer hall, nor is it the silence of this world. The hall is figurative, and the silence an interior equipoise. A state of consciousness is entered, in which all vibrations from the lower mind are stilled, and all attention withdrawn from the outer world. He, the dweller in the hall of silence, gazes wholly inwards, who would proceed towards the place of light, and hear the creative word within him, which will call into existence a veritable new creation. The neophyte must be ceaselessly on guard against the intrusion of selfish, desireful thoughts and feelings. These ensoil the whole nature, render impure the heart, and so to the spiritual individual are anathema. The temptation in the wilderness is that of selfishness, and the tempter is the remnant of egoism, still unextirpated from the soul. Only in stillness can the monad descend. Therefore, the neophyte must learn to be still. In silence alone can the logos of the soul, the God indwelling, speak the creative word. The silence before the dawn of creation must be consciously reproduced in the mind and the heart of the neophyte. Then may the interior logos manifest creatively as that occult sound which produces order out of chaos, form from formlessness, and causes a new man to be born. Amid the silence, the aspirant hears a voice which speaks to him, saying, "Empty the mind of all preoccupations and preconceptions, and let the light shine in. Empty the heart of all desire, and let pure love shine through. Empty the soul of all personal ambition, and let the fire of aspiration exalt thee. Empty thy whole being of self and selfishness, that selflessness may become thine inmost quality. Then illumination can occur. Then progress can be made. Then mastery of the lower self by the higher can be attained. Practice, therefore, self-emptying. Denude thyself of self. Become no thing, that a new thing may arise from deep within thee. No faintest tinge of self-desire must taint the white purity of thy soul. No tremor from the desireful world below must break the silence of thy mind. The whole self must be held still in expectancy, as one awaiting the first light of dawn, the first footfalls of an approaching friend. Thus robed in purity, thus rooted in stillness, thus poised expectantly, the soul of man receives its inward light, hears its inmost voice, and by the light and sound becomes newborn. A new life then begins, illumined increasingly by an inward light and directed by an inward voice. The soul's gaze is now drawn increasingly towards the innermost, the Holy of Holies, containing the soul's sanctuary and shrine, abode of the true Father in heaven, where a new son is to be born of that Father's light and voice. In the soul's new spiritual infancy, the Master guards and guides. In spiritual puberty, monadic light and power begin to illumine and direct from within the ever-watching and ever-listening soul. In adolescence, strength and stability are gained. In spiritual manhood, the adult life is lived. As Master, he appears before the world in his turn, seeking new candidates. Maturity brings added power and the office of Hierophant. The soul need no more gaze upon the inward light, for he has become that light. He is the voice that hitherto, as from beyond, has illumined and directed him. Himself the light, he sheds that light in fiery beams into the souls of other men, enlightening and awakening them. Himself a voice, he now instructs and directs his fellow men. Ultimately, he who long ago was newborn dies to the world and planet, which was his human home, and ascends to a state of worldlessness where only pure light and perfect harmony exist. Therein he disappears from mortal view, merged in the universal soul from which shone forth the light and sounded forth the voice by which all things were made. Thereafter, eternal silence reigns for him. Rooted in stillness, he is then immovable by aught outside himself. He is as a pillar in the temple of the universe. He has found and trodden the pathway to perfection. Chapter 3 of The Pathway to Perfection, entitled The One Will. The occult life is one in which the hitherto hidden powers of man are studied, awakened, developed, and mastered. These powers are the heritage of every human being, are in fact the very substance of the soul. Basically, there is but one parent power in both universe and man. It is the power of will, the irresistible thrust of pure spirit, driving life downwards and outwards from the source and center to the field and the circumference. The one force is quite impersonal, though not blind. It is an energy imbued with intelligence, a power self-directed according to law. It is the Atman of the Hindu metaphysician and the will of the Western philosopher. It is the basis of existence, the foundation force of the universe, and the power in man which makes for righteousness, which means for evolution. It is omnipresent and omniscient, but does not reach omnipotence until the end of the evolutionary age. This force arises from deep within the womb of nature, which is the virginal, formless sea of boundless space. It is the first product of the union of universal spirit and universal space. It is the sun by whom all things were and still are made. The firstborn of many brethren is endowed with consciousness, knows the purpose for which it has been made. Its goal is fullness, its inherent impulse to expand. Meeting the resistance of matter, conflict at once begins, the everlasting Armageddon, by means of which fullness is attained and ordered expansion achieved. Infinite and inexhaustible, the one will seizes upon the substance of universal space with ever-growing power and ever deeper penetration. Behind is the irresistible thrust based on and derived from absolute power and awakened will to expand. Substance yields as it ever must, and at last the deepest depths, the limits of the evolutionary field, are reached. In this universe, these limits are the four elements of the physical world from which all nature is formed. By the word elements is meant the subtile, unmixed essences of earth, water, air and fire, and the objective substances produced by their varied combinations. Life then follows in the wake of will and molds the impregnated substance into forms. Forms in their turn yield to life as substance yielded to will. Beauty dawns as a sunlight shed upon the world. Sensitivity within the forms increases in response to pressure towards fullness from within and to impacts from without. Sensitivity breeds instinct in plant and animal, self-consciousness in man. The lion becomes the sphinx, man-headed and eagle-winged. The sphinx's age-long wait is ended in due time. Upright then, its eagle wings are spread. It mounts on high to realms of abstract thought. The human head predominates. The animal form is outgrown. Man stands erect, an individual, a microcosm in which will and life are conjoined in full self-consciousness, as earlier they were joined at the forming of the universe. Self-willed, self-vitalized, self-directed, man is a free being in a universe ruled only by law. At first, freedom is grievously misused. The outraged law, itself not without consciousness and conscious representatives, the outraged law makes manifest its unchangeable decrees. Pain comes to teach the way of righteousness and make of man a law-abiding citizen of the universe. The thrust of fullness must be self-controlled. The will to mourn us must not impede the expansion of any other citizen, for that is universal law. Man learns, obeys, finds fuller freedom in obedience, and at last becomes the law. Then is he really man, threefold, built of will, of life, and law, the ever-blessed Trinity. He then begins self-consciously and deliberately to study, develop, and control these threefold powers within himself. He now seeks, through will, mastery of life and law, and so he studies occultism, the science of the hidden divine life in nature and in man. He takes up the occult life, finds and treads the occult way. He turns inwards towards his inmost will self, which is the universal Atman centered in him as a fiery spark, component of the universal flame. He seeks that will which is for him the only reality, the parent of all else in him, and the essential man. For all seekers and all occultists, this is the great quest of all the ages. Its fulfillment in self-discovery crowns the occult life. Thereafter, the one power of the universe becomes increasingly his tool. Applied by intellect to the lower man, it empowers and at the same time purifies and beautifies the outer self and life. Will grows in power, substance loses hold. Intellect, the linking third, grows in knowledge, force, and mastery. That which so long has been occult becomes overt, and a new life is lived. This inner life concerns the formless attributes of nature and of man, the abstract mind and wisdom love from which spiritual perception comes. Finally, the will undergoes deliberate development. The higher self, yielding to the Atman, expands and is empowered and also beautified. The macrocosm, the greater the universal world, now becomes the field. Universal light shines down into the awakened self, responsive now to its power. At last, the great blending occurs, in which the microcosm temporally disappears to re-become with full self-consciousness and memory the macrocosm as a whole. There is duality no more. The two are one. This is the goal for man, to perfect the part and then surrender it to the whole. This, in outline and in essence, is the occult life. This, its purpose and its goal. Chapter 4, The Laws of the Spiritual Life. The practice of the spiritual life consists of a systematic subordination of thought, feeling, and action to the necessities of spiritual unfoldment. Rules exist, but they are those of natural law applied to the end of attainment. The impulse to unfoldment and attainment is inherent and active throughout all nature. It is the result of the irresistible and continuous pressure of spirit encased in matter, a pressure towards expansion and fullness. Spiritually awakened man is aware of this impulse within him. Aspirants to superhumanity consciously cooperate with this interior power, deliberately submit themselves to it, and apply it in concentrated form to the conduct of their lives. The laws of the spiritual life are nature's laws applied to man who is seeking swift ascent to superhumanity. In essence, they are simple and not very numerous. One law underlies them all. It is that entry upon each new phase of growth is accompanied and made possible by a renunciation or figurative death of the protection afforded to life during the preceding phase. Shall I read that again? The laws of the spiritual life are nature's laws, applied to man seeking swift ascent to superhumanity. In essence, they are simple and not very numerous. One law underlies them all. It is that entry upon each new phase of growth is accompanied and made possible by a renunciation or figurative death of the protection afforded to life during the preceding phase. The husk must die before a grain grows into a plant. The eggshell must break before the chick can emerge. So also with man, whose shell is self-centeredness and accentuated individuality. These two qualities, self-centeredness and accentuated individuality, these two must be removed and displaced by the characteristics of the new phase, which are selflessness and I-lessness. The first rule of the spiritual life, therefore, is that self must die. Selfishness must be outgrown, and accentuated egohood must be abandoned. From these broken and discarded shells or husks, a new man emerges, who is ego-less and increasingly unified with the all-pervading life. This change will occur naturally as racial evolution proceeds, but the aspirant to superhumanity deliberately forces it upon himself, hastens a natural process by the intensive application of mind and will to that end. Nothing unnatural is attempted, nothing abnormal occurs, save the speed at which the natural process is completed. This is the governing principle of the spiritual life, that nature's laws are deliberately applied to himself by the aspirant to the end of quickened evolution out of the human into the superhuman kingdom. This demands constant self-recollection, in which the new purpose for living is kept continually in the forefront of the mind until it influences every thought and deed. The would-be occultist thus becomes the embodiment of a single idea, which is that hastened unfoldment attain by means of constantly applied interior pressure. Hastened unfoldment is attained by means of constantly applied interior pressure. Needless to say, this pressure must be applied scientifically, regularly, and consistently, for that is nature's way. Though she may rest seasonally, the pressure to growth is never wholly withdrawn. So also the man who seeks the stature and powers of the Superman maintains a continuous pressure in the direction of that ideal and that goal. As nature has her seasons of spring, summer, autumn, and winter, in which the degree of pressure of growth varies, so man orders his day and his life in accordance with the method of her who is his ever-present and ever-followed guide. He employs the hours of his day and the periods of his life in a manner conducive to the end in view. Morning is his spring, as high noon is his summer, evening his autumn, and night his winter time. Each morning, pressure in the direction of ego-lessness is applied, that the shell may be weakened and eventually broken. Each forenoon, study occupies the mind, that the principles of both natural and hastened growth may be more fully grasped. At high noon, that intensest pressure is applied in contemplation of that which is the one in all and the all in one. The remainder of the day is devoted to living out in constant watchfulness the ideals of the occult life. The world, his fellow men, failure and success, and the increasing action of causative law become his teachers. Detached from them, even whilst in their midst, he learns from them his own success and mistakes chiefly illumine him as he seeks and finds the principles which govern and produce them both. These basic principles and natural laws are the objects of his study, and their continuous application to himself is his supreme preoccupation. Herein is encountered and must be solved the first of many paradoxes of the higher life. While seeking selflessness, he must increasingly observe himself. Self-watchfulness rather than introspection is the ideal, whilst throughout the sublime motive must never be forgotten. It is to become consciously unified with the one life throughout the whole cosmos, to offer that life the most perfect, fullest, freest expression, and to help that life to fullness and freedom in other forms which imprison and even torture it. These are the purposes of the great endeavor. Service is the keynote of the quest, and the Superman is above all one who serves. The purpose for self-watchfulness and self-development is not that of selfish gain. On the contrary, it is to disappear as separated self and to aid all other men to that attainment. Thus is solved in thought, in motive, and in action the seeming paradox of selflessness and self-watchfulness. Since the ideal is self-deliverance from the prison of self-individuality, the state of oneness with the life in all is continually envisaged.